Good morning, everyone, once again. Thanks for joining in, and I trust you had a good night overnight last night. I did want to, we don't have too much further to go again in the presentation, it's just a few slides. But once we finish with the slides, I will come back to the question that, on the OTC markets, which I'll answer at the end of this. And then at the back end of that particular slide, what I will also do is open up any further questions that persons may have. So we probably will finish a little bit ahead of the schedule. But what I would also do beyond today is that I will probably share some sample questions with you guys. So at least you get a sense of some of the computational questions that go along with the presentation. I didn't want to spend a lot of time doing those computational type questions and then run out of time in terms of not finishing the presentation. So I will share those via the ECSE team, and then you'll get those probably before the week is out. All right, so let me just pick back up from where we left off yesterday. I think we were just finishing off on the term structure of interest rates. And essentially, this is really just a graphical representation between yields on bonds of the same credit quality, but at different maturities. I think we all would have probably seen something like this, even from a theoretical perspective of what an interest rate curve looks like. This is the US one, but there are similar examples in Jamaica, in the Eastern Caribbean, as well as in Trinidad and Barbados. So essentially gives a sample or a sense of what a default risk credit curve would look like based on treasuries that are available in the marketplace from the most current, which would be a short-term T-bills, notes and bonds, through your intermediate bonds, and then your longer-term bonds. So moving on from there, we went through the expectations and the market segmentation series yesterday as well. And I hope that wasn't too challenging for you guys either. So where we sort of paused yesterday was really on classes of bonds. And essentially the classes of bonds that I probably want to identify here is ones that we've been speaking about as of yesterday, but I think your ones that you'd be familiar with as well, just based on your experience. Again, treasury securities would be the most common type of bonds that or short-term securities that you would know. These are backed by the full faith and credit of any particular government, and that those can be governments in the region from an EC standpoint or further afield in terms of the Caribbean standpoint. These would be determined to be the least risky assets of a particular country. And as a result, the interest rates on these instruments would be lower than most other interest-bearing instruments available. So examples of treasury securities would be bills, notes, bonds issued by a particular government. What you also have as well is agency bonds or parastatal bonds or state enterprise bonds or any bonds that are issued by agencies of government that don't necessarily or may not necessarily have a direct obligation to the government, but essentially benefit from having support from the government. So these would be your government guaranteed bonds. And there are a couple of examples I would have mentioned yesterday concerning that. In Trinidad, it would be our water authority and our electricity distribution company. But there are many examples that are exist throughout the region. Barbados has quite a few. Their sugar manufacturing company, which is the Barbados Agricultural Manufacturing Company, they would have benefited from a lot of government guaranteed obligations over the years. And Jamaica has similar types as well. So essentially, these are borrowings of agencies owned or controlled by the government of a particular country. We also have examples of corporate bonds that exist in the marketplace. And here are some examples of corporate bonds that we have. Again, some corporations do offer utility type services. Those can be electric, gas distribution, telephone. In Trinidad, for example, our telecommunications company was previously government owned, but was privatized maybe two or three decades ago. So that's actually a corporate entity rather than a government-owned entity. Gas distribution and transmission in Trinidad, we also had a change as well. The transmission is still government-owned, but the gas distribution or the electricity generation side of it is not privately owned. Electricity, essentially, in some of the islands, is no longer government-owned. Barbados Light and Power is actually owned by a company called Emera out of Canada, I believe. And there are other examples around the Caribbean region where a lot of international companies have come in and through privatization gathered ownership of electricity generation. So Jamaica is another example where that has occurred. And what happens is that they will partner with the government of the day to provide electricity to the country. And the way that those companies are funded is through government or through bonds, corporate bonds that are offered to the marketplace, be it in a particular country or in the region or in the international markets. Other classes of corporate bonds would be those for airlines and railroads. This would obviously be a North American or European example because we don't have too many examples of railroads or airlines borrowing money. The only example that exists from an airline point of view is that years ago, the National Airline Trinidad and Tobago, which was then British West Indian Airways, which is now Caribbean Airlines, they actually did some debt financing, but those have long since been retired. And essentially, Caribbean Airlines essentially is funded through the government of Trinidad and Tobago directly. You can also have banks and finance companies issuing corporate debt as well as industrials. Some examples of banks issuing debt that I would be familiar with, Royal Bank of Canada out of Trinidad would have issued bonds in the past. You also would have had, for example, First Citizens Bank issuing debt in the past. Scotia Bank has been an issuer of debt. Republic Bank out of Trinidad right now is seeking to issue some debt as well. So these would be your various classes of bonds and various types of issuers of corporate bonds throughout the region. To give you a sense of bond ratings as well, again, bond ratings essentially give a formal opinion by a specialized service company that we would have mentioned before, S&P, Moody's, Dun & Bradstreet, Fitch, Carrie Christen in Trinidad that would basically provide services to the region. So essentially, they would give a formal opinion of the default risk of a particular issuing entity for their debt securities. The bond ratings are forward-looking assessment of the likelihood or probability of default. It gives a sense of the magnitude of the loss of default. And as you can see on the right-hand side, there is a rating scale that each of these rating companies do provide. The rating scale essentially is divided in two, investment grade and junk, and you have classes within each of those wider segments. So bond ratings can move via upgrades, downgrades, or rating watches. Upgrades, as the name suggests, is an improvement in its credit quality. A downgrade is the reverse, where there's a particular deterioration. And a ratings watch is advanced notice that they can be a positive, which is an upgrade, or negative downgrade movement in the particular rating. Within the investment grade rating, you have particular meanings attached to the particular ratings. As you would see, the highest class of investment grade rating would be AAA by all of these various rating agencies. And those would be your prime or your gilt edge or your high grade issuers. And then you would come down the investment grade rating scale and then through that to the junk rating scale. And essentially, there are companies that would fall within that junk status as well. To the point where you'd have companies that would be either in default or in selected default. You probably would be aware the most recent occurrence of a Caribbean entity going into default would be the government of Barbados. Unfortunately, early this year, maybe at about June, if not July, The new administration, which is the Motley administration, would have come to the market and announced that Barbados does not have the wherewithal to continue to service its debt obligations, and they would have initially gone into what is called selective default. And then thereafter, when they couldn't actually come up with the cash to fund the particular interest and or principal payments, they would have gone into actual default. Just a little bit more about that is that the IMF would have come in, as you probably would appreciate and would have heard, the IMF would have come in and come up with a restructuring package and some standby arrangements and facilities for the government of Barbados to bring them out of that default scenario back into the capital markets. It's a little bit early to say exactly where they may be or where they may end up because the restructuring scenarios have not been finalized. But presumably, once these things are concretized, Barbados will now step out of a default scenario and now trade in a speculative scenario. Whether that's in the CCC range or single B range is yet to be determined. So apart from having particular ratings, all these issuers would also have outlooks attached to their rating. And an outlook simply is a projection of whether the rating is likely to change in the long term. And those outlook changes can be positive, negative, or stable. A positive outlook will give the sense that the rating could likely be upgraded or improved. Negative would obviously be the converse, and stable means a likely no change in a particular rating. So bond price volatility. So bond price volatility will change over time for a couple of reasons, one of which is the perceived credit risk of the issuer. Another is change in interest rates within the market. And essentially, the third one would be a premium or discount bond as it approaches to maturity. We would have mentioned yesterday, as bonds do approach the maturity time period, they would move from a price perspective to par. And so if the bond is trading at a discount, it would increase in price to par on the prospect that the principal is going to be repaid in its full quantum. And the opposite is also true. If a bond is trading at a premium relative to the market, then that price of the bond will trend down towards par as it begins to approach its maturity date. With respect to option-free bonds, just something to be mindful of is that for any given term to maturity and initial yield, the price volatility of the bond is greater the lower the coupon rate. And additionally, for given coupon and initial yield, the longer the term to maturity, the greater the price volatility. So if you have a long-dated bond versus a short-dated bond, you're likely to see greater price volatility in the longer-dated security than in shorter-dated security. Moving on, just to give you a sense, and this really, price volatility is really a precursor to duration, and the duration really is a financial concept that seeks to measure the level of price sensitivity to small changes in bond yields. So essentially, how the price changes for infinitesimally small changes in interest rates. As you would appreciate, duration is usually inversely related to the coupon of the bond. So the higher the coupon, the lower the duration of the bond. Duration is also inversely related to yield to maturity. So the higher the yield, the lower the duration when coupon and maturity are kept constant. And the last point, I think, from a property standpoint that we want to measure to you guys is where there are large changes in interest rates, duration is not a fairly good measure of the change in the price of the bond. The yield curve or interest rates essentially are concave in nature. And essentially, duration is a tangential, and not to get too much into the math, but duration is a tangential measure, which is a line at a point. And because of the curve nature the tangent isn't able to capture significant movements along that curve. So therefore, there is another measure that is looked at, which is actually convexity. And the convexity takes into account that curve nature of the curve to to better measure the price volatility. So convexity is a measure of the change in the price of a bond for changes in yields by more than a small amount. So it's essentially just a better way to measure changes that are not as small as with respect to duration. So convexity seeks to capture the curvature or convexity associated with a bond. And convexity also has a couple of properties that we should be aware of. As the required yield increases, then the convexity of a bond would decrease. And this is referred to as positive convexity. Similarly, the opposite is true. As the required yield decreases, the convexity of a bond will increase. So some other properties to be mindful of is that given the yield curve to maturity, the lower the coupon, the greater the convexity of the bond. Similarly as well, for given yield and modified duration, the lower the coupon, the smaller the convexity. So be mindful of your duration measures and your convexity measures. There is a significant mass surrounding both of these two concepts that's tied into derivatives or derivatives calculations, differentiation. So I would stay away from the math for the purposes of this presentation because it's fairly lengthy to go through and it may be a little bit beyond the purposes of this particular course. But I think any financial book will have the duration math and the convexity math if you're quite interested in it. And essentially that would be the entire presentation that I have. What I'd like to do is I would like to switch and share a different presentation, which is the comments that we had previously about OTC markets. Right, so OTC markets, I think the question yesterday Are you guys seeing the screen by chance?
We're seeing it now.
No.
Right. So. Okay. Okay. Let's put it on here. So, okay. So, OTC markets. You guys can still see the screen, right?
Yes.
Okay, let me do this and see if this helps. Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so OTC markets. So OTC markets essentially are decentralized markets. There is no physical location that exists, or no formal exchange, like a NASDAQ or an NYSE or a London Stock Exchange. So in OTC markets, essentially what you have is market makers or dealers that may be quoting prices at which they would buy or sell securities or financial products. This would be dissimilar to what happens in the Eastern Caribbean market, where through the ECSM platform, there is always a quotation system associated with securities. So there is little opportunity for trading within the securities market in the Eastern Caribbean region outside of the formal exchange. But in OTC markets, a trade can be executed between participants without other market players being aware of a trade going through or price at which that would have gone through. So as you would appreciate, OTC markets tend to be less transparent than formal exchanges and are subject to fewer regulations than exchanges would be. So Trinidad does have a fairly strong OTC market when compared to its formal exchange in terms of debt securities. Sorry. We actually don't in Trinidad trade a lot of securities over the exchange. And a lot of the trading activity that occurs by way of fixed income instruments is bilateral and happens really in, from an OTC standpoint. So what I've tried to list in the third paragraph here is some of the players from a Trinidad perspective that are market makers from an OTC point of view, that being Citibank, RBC, Republic Bank, and pretty much all of the major banks that exist in Trinidad, but these would be the primary ones. And they traditionally come into the market where they buy and sell securities, or trade amongst themselves as banks, or they would sell off to other institutional investors in Trinidad, be it the National Insurance Board, which is our social security system, the Unit Trust Corporation, which is our largest mutual fund provider, and other insurance companies and pension plans that do exist. As I would have mentioned before, most of these transactions don't cross any formal exchange, and pricing is really, and price determination is really negotiated between the parties, where it begins to become more art than science at a particular point in time. So OTC markets do exist, but this is probably the closest example that I could find to our particular scenario that does exist.
Hi, Stephen. Is it similar to an odd lot?
An odd lot sometimes occurs, and Trinidad is an odd lot system, I believe, but would that not also be via formal exchange as well?
To my knowledge, no, but I may be wrong.
Because in a Trinidad example, we do allow for some odd lot amounts to go through where price over an exchange, but price doesn't necessarily move with an odd lot trade. Because it's so small, it crosses an exchange at a particular price, which is visible to other market participants. But it may not necessarily at any of the day, depending on the volume that's traded, it may not necessarily trigger a price movement of that particular issuer. So an odd lot, yes, but I think it's dependent on the arrangements surrounding odd lots. We have an odd lot across a formal exchange, but if you can have odd lots move around informally between parties on a bilateral basis. But it sounds like it could be.
Okay.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. So that was OTC markets, and what I will do is I will share this with the Alicia and the team, so at least you can add this to the presentation. I don't have too much else to present, and I'm pretty much about 20 minutes ahead of schedule. So I don't know if there are any questions that anybody has on this, on anything else that they may want to ask me, or generally about markets that they have a burning desire to ask.
Mr. Thomas, under OTC markets, for example, Citibank, Royal Bank, Canada, the securities that they issue, are they securities that they raise or they buy from the government?
Both. So essentially, each of these banks, Citibank, Royal Bank of Canada, and Republic Bank, do have within their holding company structure investment banking departments. So they sometimes do arrange securities. And these will not be loans, these will actually be securities, particularly for government and some corporations. And during the arranging process, they would sell some of these securities to market, which is the primary market activity, and they may also hold back some of these bonds for their own inventory as well, and sell into the market depending on where interest rates may be from time to time. So they can sell all outright, or they can sell some after the issuing date or issuing period belatedly to the market via the secondary market. They may also buy securities back from the market. Sometimes when investors are pressed for cash, there have been instances where these banks have bought securities back from players like the National Insurance Board and Unit Trust Corporation to provide them with cash, and or other investors wanting to get bonds that they were not able to participate in the primary market, they have come back to these banks and said, listen, do you have within your inventory, or can you go into the market and purchase bonds for us at a particular price? So there is a set, there is a lot of activity that takes place in an OTC environment in Trinidad, outside of a formal exchange between or amongst the largest players in the market. And it allows for the quick movement of bonds between parties, but this is really outside of a regulatory process via our stock exchange, which has a bond trading platform. And it also is reported more likely to the central bank through its regulation of financial intermediaries rather than through our Securities and Exchange Commission, which is not capturing the securities transactions that move from time to time. Does that help?
Yes, it does. But how does it affect the secondary market?
Well, again, you don't have the publication of pricing information. So it really does provide a challenge sometimes when you're trying to price securities as you go forward. But what happens is price discovery or pricing information does enter the market from a different point of view. The government in Trinidad tends to be the largest issuer of instruments, fixed income instruments, that is. So what happens usually is the because of the frequent issuance by the government of instruments in Trinidad and Tobago, not just short-term treasury instruments, which is 3 months, 6 months, 1 year, but the government is usually issuing 5-year paper, 7-year paper, 10-year paper, 15-year paper. So there are some data points or tenor points that is available to the marketplace that does get publicized by our central bank or in the press. And through bootstrapping or interpolation, the players in the market are able to make estimates of the other points that are not issued by the government. So, for example, the 6-year point, the 8-year point, the 12-year point. Through interpolation and bootstrapping, we can basically get estimates of what those points are. And then so we, based on that, we can essentially build our own yield curve from available market data, as well as information that we would have based on prior issuances. But we can also ask the markets directly, if you have a particular tenor point for which you don't have pricing information, we can just simply ask the investor, at what price would you be willing to buy an issue in this particular tenor space? And that information is real and live. So if you can basically deliver the security at that particular price or yield, then chances are the investor is going to buy it. So again, there's a lot of bilateral information, either through information that is publicly available or direct conversation to build out a yield curve across all tenor points. Over time, there's just really negotiation to really see what is a best fit price or yield for securities involved.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Any other questions? Okay. Well, like I mentioned, I do have, so I will share some questions with you guys, like I said, before the week is out. But if you have any questions or concerns, I'm more than happy to answer them before the exam. So I really just want to wish you all the very best in the upcoming exam.
I have one more question, sorry.
No problem.
Will, for the purpose of the exam, will we be asked to calculate duration or convexity? No, please.
I won't put on the scientific formula.
Okay.
So I know that duration and convexity are a bit challenging. What I will say is I will try and make it as qualitative as possible so that you don't have to get into the heavy math, and where the heavy math, where there is math, it will not be heavy. But to be quite honest, I haven't gone through all the questions as yet. So, I don't want to necessarily say it is or it is not there. I just haven't gotten around to writing the questions, but I do appreciate that it is a heavier topic, particularly for those that have not been exposed to finance for a long period of time. So I will try to be judicious where duration and convexity are concerned.
Okay.
Steven, one more question. Will we be expected to memorize the formulas, or will we be given a formula sheet?
I don't know. I probably will have to ask Alicia that. I mean, it does help if you do know the formulas, but I do appreciate that outside of this particular course, you have other formulas that you may have to either know or memorize. But let me take that offline with Alicia and probably clarify that for you as well.
Yes, Stephen, we would normally give out, well, in past exams, we have given out the financial ratios.
Right.
Haven't included any for the evaluations and all of that. So that's something we may consider including or providing.
Right, but then everybody would have a financial calculator, I presume.
Yes, it's a requirement for the for the exam.
Right. So the calculator essentially is the formula built into the device. So if you can operate a calculator, then you probably don't need the formula.
Yeah.
But if you do have a calculator, you have an advantage already.
Yeah, it is a requirement for the exam, a financial calculator.
All right. But I will not, I will try not to give you the hardest formulas to memorize or work through. And it really isn't about the calculations, it's really about understanding the theory and the concepts involved in finance.
Okay. Thank you, Stephen, for a very comprehensive presentation. For me, I have, it's not a question, but more from an application perspective. You've given us a lot of information about evaluations and how we go about doing that. From a practical perspective, how would I, as a licensed representative or principal, you know, have to use that knowledge for my clients? So somebody comes in and they say, you know, I just won the lottery, $1 million, and I need to invest.
Mm-hmm.
How would you, using all of the information that you have provided us with incidents, a newly licensed representative, what sort of how do we go about putting all of what we've learned here to, between yesterday and today, advise clients as to how they can invest that $1 million and using the within the context of the ESM and the regional market, because obviously we have broker deals. We understand the limitations in the ECSM.
Mm-hmm.
We have access to the Trinidad market, you know, the Barbados market. So just to put things in perspective from an application point of view, how would all of this information help me as a newly licensed representative to apply in my day-to-day?
Right. So you win $1 million. Congratulations. And now you're stepping into an office of any of the registered firms that exist in the region. So the first question that any one of these firms is going to ask you is, well, tell me about your lifestyle, your investment objectives, your risk tolerance. And once you've done that risk analysis or that risk scoring, it's going to essentially spit out to the person across the table from you as to what type of instruments that you would be comfortable investing in. Or what instruments, if you went to bed at night, wouldn't keep you up worrying about them. So depending on what your risk parameters or tolerance is, you would essentially get a smattering of fixed income securities. Also, you'd get an ability to invest in equities as well. If you've won Eastern Caribbean dollars, you do have an opportunity to buy some foreign exchange through the banks to invest. But let's say that you didn't have the immediate availability of investing in US dollars only. Then you'd have to invest essentially in securities available in the Eastern Caribbean market. Those would be treasuries, bonds issued by the government, or securities issued by some of the other corporate issuers in the market. You'd also know as well, for example, depending on where you are in terms of your age and time to retirement, you would also know that part of your retirement package or remuneration should include some investing in equities. So you'd want to invest in some of these 13 listed equities on the Eastern Caribbean Securities Market. And with foreign exchange, you'd probably want to invest from a diversification point of view. You'd also want to invest in other securities available in the marketplace. Those could be in Trinidad, and those can be essentially fixed income or equities as well. Or you could invest in other instruments in the U.S. markets, mutual funds, alternative investments. You can invest in art. You can invest in commodities, oil, metals. You can invest in any variety of instruments. And depending on where you are in terms of what's available to you in terms of the investment landscape, you may be investing, for example, in secondary market instruments, those that already have been listed on an exchange, or you may be investing in, for example, OTC instruments that a bank may have in its own inventory that it may make available to you, or you may be willing to wait until an IPO comes up to invest, particularly in the U.S. market. If you, for example, want to invest in technology stocks, there may be a technology stock that is available to invest in. If you want a little bit more money, then you may become a venture capitalist and seek to fund certain small businesses or enterprises in your own home market. So you may actually want to be a financier of small businesses back home, or you may also want to basically provide seed capital or funding capital to an entity that exists outside of your particular region and buy into that as well. So essentially, what this does, or what this course essentially is seeking to do, is to show you what the arsenal of security instruments that exist and what those classes are. Each of these instruments have their own nuances of risk and return. So therefore, you have to be mindful that you are essentially investing in a wide variety of instruments. The key is not to invest in any one particular class or all in one class or all in one instrument, but you want to basically buy a little bit of everything based on your particular needs and your investment horizon and your risk tolerances. You want to be mindful that these instruments have risk, and therefore some of the instruments that would exist in international markets would be rated by the same rating companies like a Standard & Poor's and S&P and a Moody's. But you also want to be mindful of what has been historical pricing of these instruments. You want to look essentially at how, particularly from an equity standpoint, how they've performed, which would have been your financial analysis course yesterday. But from a trading aspect, are they overvalued or undervalued relative to the market? You'd also want to look at reading some credit reports or some rating agency reports on some issuers to give you a sense of how companies are performing or how sovereign governments are performing. What else you probably want to look at? You want to look at essentially what information is available to you in terms of research and information, and you want to read that research information to take advantage of information and essentially instruments that are traded over a variety of exchanges and a variety of mediums. What else can I say inside there? I'm just trying to think of the presentation as we speak now. And you also want to be mindful of where investors tend to congregate. So we spoke about the expectation theory and the market segmentation theory. If certain investors crowd into a particular tenor point, then that particular tenor point is likely to have liquidity in terms of buying or selling instruments at the disadvantage of other areas, particularly on a tenor point where it may be less liquid. And because of less liquidity, there may be a wider bid-ask spread, and therefore you may suffer some capital loss because you have this variability in terms of pricing. The course would have also gone through as well that even though a company may be performing well and you may be comfortable with its risk, in the wider scheme of the market, there is a concern about geopolitical issues or event risk or inflation or interest rate risk or market risk or any of the other types of risks that exist in the market. And therefore, you don't want necessarily to pigeonhole your analysis to any one particular company, but have a very wide spectrum or very wide view of what's taking place in the market. So you're always informed of events that may be affecting your markets or side markets that you may be in or may want to get in. So it's really having a very comprehensive and broad approach of where markets are and where they are trending, and looking at particular instruments that you may want to invest in, and essentially be diversified in your need. What you also want to be mindful of as well too is with any investment strategy that you must essentially constantly review, have particular goals and benchmarks in mind set up from the onset, but you constantly want to review maybe at least once a year, preferably twice a year, to make sure that you're meeting those return and risk objectives. And if you're not meeting those, you probably want to do some rebalancing or refocusing to see where you've gone wrong and get back on track. So I think that pretty much, I hope, is what we would have covered over the course of the last few hours where this was concerned, the last 2 to 3 hours where this was concerned. Does that help?
Yes, very, very comprehensive. It's sort of brought everything together, you know, in a nice summary package. So thanks for that. And that we have no further questions, and we're almost at 9:45. So I want to say thanks again, Stephen, for your presentation. I especially liked the fact that you brought in examples of
From the region,
especially in the ECSC and ECSM, and contrasted that with what happens in other markets in the region. That was I found to be adding to the comprehensiveness of the whole presentation.
Yeah, you're very welcome, because I know it's sometimes hard to get context around what may happen in the US environment, and we have a lot of examples within our region. So I think it's better, where possible, to use those examples first, and worst case, go to the international examples afterwards.
Yeah. Perfect. Excellent. Okay, so thanks again. And when you submit the practice questions, we will forward to the candidates. And of course, if they have any questions, you can channel through us, and we will send or you may choose to respond to them directly. But we will be... for the clients, for the candidates, for any questions or any things that they have on the practice questions that you may have.
That's no problem. That's no problem at all. Happy to do that.
Okay. Thanks.
You're very welcome. Best of luck, guys, and good luck in the exam.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, good morning, Mr. Lawrence. I see that you're on.
Yeah, I'm here early.
Have better luck today.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yes, you're right on time, so it's 9:45. So without further ado, I'll let you get started.
Okay, let me just download my presentation. 1 minute. It should be here. Tell me when you see it.
Okay.
You're seeing it now?
Yes, it's up.
Okay.
You might need to do the slideshow view.
I will, yeah. Okay, great.
Okay, wonderful. It's up.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Faiza. I'm assuming it's the same group that I have as previously.
Yes.
Okay, well, today we are going to be looking at the basics of portfolio management and asset allocation. And this slide gives an overview of the areas that we will cover: understanding efficient portfolios, diversification, modern portfolio theory, financial instrument and investment vehicles, the basics of asset allocation, portfolio management strategies. If you look at this, you'd recognize that this is probably a two-semester course in any university. But the focus here is not to go into the detailed mathematical derivations, but to put you in a position where you can understand the basic principles and that you can actually use them in your day-to-day functions. So some, for those of you who are theoretically and academically rigorous, you may find that we probably apply just a surface brush, but you certainly have the opportunity to read in far more details, and I'm sure there are a number of good textbooks that you can look and would cover the same material. Understanding efficient portfolios. One of the purpose of advising clients is to choose for them or help them in choosing a portfolio of investments that would achieve their objectives. And I say achieve their objectives because clients have many objectives. And as we go further on, we would look at how you would interact with a client and what information you'd get and what factors you'll take into consideration in coming up with an investment plan for them. The interesting thing is that every investor has a different utility function, and we call it a utility function. It just says every investor has their own preferences. If an investor is very old and looking to retire or have retired, then a steady flow of income would be of interest to him, and he might like stocks that have a good dividend record. If he's young and looking to go to university 20 years down the road or to provide for his eventual retirement, provided he has enough time, then he might be interested in growth stocks. Of course, everything depends on the risk appetite, how much risk he's. If you are not a risky person and you do not want to risk your principal at all, then that might restrict you to bonds, etc. So that you as an investment advisor would have to thoroughly examine the person, get as much information as you want, and come up with a structure or come up with an investment plan that meet their varying objectives. The good thing is that you do not have to look at every possible portfolios. A lot of the theory have shown that the portfolio of interest, the portfolios of interest are few. They are literally on what we call an efficient frontier. I will discuss the efficient frontier more. And then it's a question of deciding which one of those portfolios on the efficient frontier that would be best suit your client's objectives. In asset allocation, in efficient portfolio selection, there are some critical things that you need to be aware of. One is asset allocation. Now, when you hear about the stock market, you hear people choosing Apple, or they're choosing Microsoft, and they're looking for if it goes up and down, and they're selecting when to buy, etc., etc. The theory says that the biggest benefits come from how you allocate into asset classes, not necessarily how you time the market or how you choose individual securities. And so that the classes that you will find would be bonds, stock, cash. You might also find foreign investment versus domestic investment. So that if you can identify those class and decide on the best way to apportion your investment between those classes, and that is what is called asset allocation, then you will have a good chance of achieving your objectives. There's no need to actually go down into the heavy detail about the various stocks, et cetera, because some of those stocks, some of the performances of the portfolio would be affected by diversification, which means if you have 30 stocks, some will go up, some will go down, but you can eliminate that risk because the ups and downs would cancel out each other, and so that you will have a steady movement in accordance with the market. There's two types of risk that our portfolios have. They have what we call systematic risk, and they have unsystematic risk. Unsystematic risk is peculiar to the stocks. In other words, whether the company has a good manager, whether or not they have industrial actions at the company, whether there is some regulatory action against the company. Those are company-specific things that will affect the price of the stock. And those are called unsystematic risk. And they are unsystematic in the sense that they do not affect the system as a whole. They affect the particular enterprise. You also have systematic risk. And these are the risks associated with the system as a whole. And some people call it market risk. So that these are things that affect the economy as a whole, that affect all stocks together. And you'll see the effects of that when you're looking at the markets and you're seeing that the Dow Jones is going up or down, or the Standard & Poor's is going up and down. They are being influenced by factors that affect the market as a whole. They're influenced by some individual factors. There are some big, big firms that are also big enough to influence the indices, but primarily, it would be systematic factors, like if Trump makes some statement or if the Fed decide to increase interest rates. Those are things that affect the system as a whole. What the theory has suggested is that the market will only pay for systematic risk. The market will not pay for unsystematic risk. There is what you call a premium that investors pay. So for example, you can go and invest in government securities which are deemed risk-free. And you will have a really good chance of eliminating default risk. That used to be so once upon a time, it's no longer so because governments do default. But that certainly is the theory. And it depends on which government. Now, for you to be encouraged or incentivized to go into other securities with higher risk, you will have to be paid a premium. So that if government securities are giving you 5%, you may decide, look, for me to go into IBM, I need 8%. Then that 3% differential is your risk premium. The market will not give you a risk premium in relation to unsystematic risk. It will give you a risk premium only in relation to risk that is market-wide. And why is that? Because unsystematic risk can be diversified away. If you get 20 to 30 securities in your portfolio, and they are not perfectly correlated with one another, then that in itself will make sure that you can get away from the unsystematic risk. There might be some problems in one company, but that will be compensated for by good performances in another company. So the ups and downs of the companies within the portfolio will get rid of the unsystematic risk, but it will not get rid of the systematic risk. And so you will have investors will expect a premium if they're going to take on systematic risk. Now, different companies respond differently, have different degrees of market risk or systematic risk. For example, when the market moves, say, 10%, the S&P moves 10%, some company may move exactly 10%, so they move in sync with the market. Some companies, when the market moves 10%, they might only move 5%, so they are less risky than the market itself. And when the market moves 10%, some companies may move 15%. So it means then that even in relation to market risk and market movements, it affects companies differently. And that is measured by a concept called beta. For example, if in the example I gave, if the market moved by 10% and a company consistently moved by 15%, then the company is moving by 1.5 times the market, and that 1.5 is called your beta. The beta is a measure of the sensitivity of the particular company or the particular portfolio to changes in the market. If, on the other hand, when the market moves 100, the stock moves 50, then the beta is 50%, because in response to market changes, that particular security is only moving 50% of the change in the market. And so that is the notion of beta. And that is why I said that we are not going to, in terms of the detail about how you calculate beta and so on, that is important. But certainly what is more important is that if you see a security and you see that it says it has a beta of 1.8, you know what it means, and you understand that that will have much more risk than a security that have a beta of 0.5, and you understand why. And you would understand also that that risk emanates from changes in the market. That risk is systematic risk. It has nothing to do with the individual concerns of the particular security or the particular market. It says here, the benefits of diversification initially increases with the number of securities and eventually flatten out beyond 20 to 30 securities. And those of you who did statistics would know that when you do a sample, once you do a sample up to about 30 or so, then it would be normally distributed. And so that a sample of up to 30 or so would usually mirror the population. And this is based on a similar principle. To go up to 20 or 25 securities, you would usually get the diversification you need. Now, that is a very important rule, because yes, you could get better diversification if you go up to 100 securities. But the extra little diversification benefit that you will get will be the amount of work you will have to do to follow an extra 100 securities would be really, really overwhelming. So this is a very important rule, that you could achieve your diversification objectives with just about 20 to 25 securities. I did speak about the efficient portfolio. And that was a theory developed by Harry Markowitz. But subsequently, there's a new theory which is called the capital asset pricing model. Are you losing me? You're hearing me, right?
Yeah.
There's a subsequent theory developed by called the capital asset pricing model. And basically what that says is, instead of looking at all of the portfolios on the efficient frontier, you just have to invest in a single one. And that portfolio is the market portfolio. And by combining that with the risk-free asset, you would be in a position to achieve your investment objectives. So you no longer have to go and find the efficient frontier and look at all of the different portfolios that are on the efficient frontier. If you know the market portfolio, you'd be able to combine that with a risk-free asset. And by combining the market portfolio with a risk-free asset, you would be in a position to achieve the investment objective. If you put in a lot of the risk-free asset, then what would mean? It would mean that you're reducing your risk, but it would also reduce your return. If you put in a lot of the market, it means you're increasing your risk, but you would reduce You're increasing your risk, but you'd also increase your return. As we discussed yesterday, risk and return are two different, are two opposite sides of the same currency. You cannot get more return without incurring more risk. And so that if you want to be completely safe and not incur much risk, then your return will go down. If you want a whole lot of return, then it means that you will have to incur a lot of risk to get that return. The final thing here says, now it says, the market portfolio contains all risky assets completely diversified. And the market is a, the market portfolio is a sort of abstract concept. It can include all assets that are in existence, essentially. And nothing really captures the market portfolio. But what most investment analysts does is that what they do is that they look at the standard, a broad base index like the Standard & Poor's, and they use that as a measure of the market. But theoretically, the market goes beyond that and includes all forms of assets. Everything that you could potentially invest in would constitute the market portfolio. But in practice, for an investment professional, you would use a very broad-based index as a proxy for the market portfolio. As securities not perfectly correlated are added, the average covariance of the portfolio decline. Now, there's a couple of things that I need to say to you. Risk is measured by the standard deviation or the variance of the portfolio. When you say risk in finance, you mean something very specific. When you say risk in ordinary language, anything that makes you fearful is risky. In finance, what it means is variability and volatility. So if you have a stock that goes up in price 20% today, then is down 50% tomorrow, then is up 100% the next day, then that is a very risky stock. Now, how do you capture those variability? By measuring the standard deviation of the stock. And I'm hoping everybody have done a bit of statistics and understand what standard and deviation and variance is. The standard deviation, the variance and the standard deviation is similar notions. They measure the variability of the security. The standard deviation is just the square root of the variance. So if a stock has a high standard deviation, or if the standard deviation is increasing, the variance will be increasing, because to get the variance, you just have to square the standard deviation. As securities are added to, now this is a very important point about variance. You cannot just add securities to a portfolio and expect to reduce your risk by diversification. The only way you would reduce your risk is if those securities are not perfectly correlated with the rest of the securities. So that if you have two securities, for example, and they are perfectly correlated, which means that as one goes up, the other one goes up by the same amount. As one goes down, the other one, it goes down by the same amount. If you add them together, you have not changed your risk. Everybody agrees with that? But if you have two securities, sometimes one go up, the other one goes down, or sometimes one go up and the other one don't go as far up, then if you combine them together, then what will happen is that their movement will counter one another. Sometimes one is up and it is countered by a down on the other end. So that for you to get the diversification benefits, there has to be they cannot be perfectly correlated. They cannot be moved perfectly in sync. If they move perfectly in sync, there will be no benefit, no diversification benefits from adding them together in a portfolio. It says here, total risk, and that is both systematic and unsystematic risk, is measured by standard deviation of return. We discussed that. It says also, when standard deviation of portfolio is equal to standard deviation of the market portfolio, all systematic risks have been eliminated. In other words, if you have a portfolio and the standard deviation is exactly equal to the market portfolio, then it means there are no risks beyond the market risk, beyond what you, and so that the you have enjoyed the benefits of perfect diversification, and all of the unsystematic risks have been diversified away. Anytime you do not understand anything, please feel free to stop me and I'll go over it again and I'll explain further. This slide goes in a little more detail about diversification. You have naive diversification, where you just look in a number of securities across various industries and hope for risk direction. The problem with that, as I said, if they are perfectly correlated, then you do not get the benefit of diversification. And the other thing that happens is that you could be heavily concentrated in a single industry or in a single stock, and that in itself might expose you to a significantly more risk than you'd want to undertake. If you follow portfolio theory, you will see combination of assets that are less than perfectly correlated. And that is the basic premise on which you would combine assets to achieve a portfolio and seek to minimize risk through the process of diversification. This slide is basically a slide that seeks to give some clarification in terms of some of the terms that we are using. The objective of modern portfolio theory is to combine the efficient frontier and the investor's indifference curve map to indicate which efficient portfolio satisfies the investor risk return trade-off. That's a big chunk of it. But we have discussed this already, because what I said to you is that an investor indifference curve is just an indication of his preference. And every investor have a different indifference curve. And so that whenever a person comes to you for advice, what you're doing when you're asking him a question about his appetite for risk, etc., is that you are actually trying to locate his indifference curve. And so you're matching, using the portfolio theory, you're trying to match a portfolio on the efficient frontier with the preferences of the particular investor. Here they are telling you about correlation and diversification. We have discussed that. Correlation basically is a measure of the association, of the degree of association between two variables, or in this case, between two stocks. So if the stocks move together, they are perfectly in sync with one another, they would have a correlation of one. If they are not in sync at all, they have no relationship between the stocks, they will have a correlation of zero. If they move together 50% of the times, they will have a correlation of 0.5. So that correlation coefficient can move anywhere between zero and one. And if it is near to zero, that means they are not highly correlated. If it is close to one, that means they are very, very highly correlated. To achieve the benefits of diversification, you want it to be as close to zero as possible, or even negative, because negative would suggest that as one moves up, the other one moves down. The concept of efficient portfolios we have discussed before, and we'll discuss it a little more. Utilitarian efficient portfolios we have discussed. Covariance is very similar to the correlation coefficient, but the correlation coefficient is expressed as a fraction, so it is between zero and one. The covariance measures the same thing, but it is expressed as a number, so that if it has a high covariance, it means that the two stocks are heavily related and they tend to move together. If you have a low covariance, it means that they are not closely related. So covariance and correlation are similar. It's just that in the case of correlation, it is a number. In the case of correlation, in the case of covariance, it is a number like 10, 100, whatever the case may be. And you could look at two securities and look at the correlation, the one that has the biggest covariance is the one that would have the highest risk. But for you to compare across securities, it's better to use correlation because you are able to say whether or not they are 50% related or 75% related. But we'll discuss some of these concepts as we go along. This is just a table, a computer printout that shows you two companies, Coca-Cola and Exxon, and it also shows you how you can go about calculating. It's actually a computer printout that was reproduced in a textbook, but it shows you how you go about calculating the standard deviation, the covariance, and the correlation coefficient. None of your exams will ask you to do any of those calculations. There is a number of terms that you need to know. There's a feasible set of portfolios. The portfolios, feasible set of portfolios of all is all of the portfolios that you can put together, all of the portfolios that you can invest in. So if you have 100 investments, you could combine them in many ways, and that's the feasible set of portfolios. But not all of them are efficient. Not all of them are efficient. So that the ones you are interested in are the efficient one. And when I say efficient, what do I mean? I mean, what I'm very specific, it's a mean variance efficient portfolio. Usually we just say efficient portfolio, but what we mean is mean variance efficient portfolio. What it means is that for a given risk level, the portfolio which gives the highest return would be an efficient portfolio. So that if the risk is 10%, there's a lot of portfolios with a 10% risk, but not all of them is efficient. The one that is efficient is the one that gives you the highest return for that level of risk. Or I could say it the other way around. If a portfolio is giving you 15% return, then the one that will be efficient is the one that gives you the lowest risk for that 15% return. So that the mean variance efficient portfolio is the highest return for a given level of risk or the lowest risk for a given level of return. And that is what you're trying to find. All of the portfolio that is on the efficient frontier are the highest level of return for their particular risk class. Or there are the lowest level of risk for their particular return class. Everybody understands that?
Yes.
Okay. When you don't get any response, either you're very, very clear or you're very, very muddy. Which one is it?
Mr. Lawrence, the slide with the calculation for the two stocks, could you go back to that one just for a moment?
Okay, go back.
On Exxon and I forget the other one.
Previous.
Exxon and Coca-Cola. Okay,
that's
so
correct.
On the results here, the correlation coefficient, would you say as an investor, should I buy these two stocks as part of my portfolio? Should I include them? If you're just looking at, obviously there will be other stocks in my portfolio that would assist in diversification, but from those numbers.
The thing about this though is that this is only showing, if you're assuming that they have the same level of return.
Right.
You would buy the Coca-Cola stock because it has the lower standard deviation.
Right.
So, but what this is focusing strictly on the risk side of the equation. But for you to decide on which one of these stocks you will buy, you would also have to get understanding of what return you're getting from each of them. So that this slide does not indicate the specific return that you're getting from them.
Okay. Okay. Thanks.
Okay, let's move on. And let's move on now. Set of all feasible. So the efficient frontier, although you have a whole range of feasible portfolios, the efficient frontier are those that are mean variance efficient. That is, they have the highest level of return for a given level of risk, or they have the lowest level of risk for a given level of return. And your objective is to construct portfolios on the efficient frontier. This gives you a two asset case, and it does the same thing. It calculates the variance standard deviation. It doesn't give you all the information that you need to calculate them, but it is very instructive because you can learn something about returns and risk by looking at these two. First of all, government bonds. Would you say government bonds would be risky, or more risky or less risky than large cap stocks?
Less risky.
Yes. It would be less risky. Because remember that government bonds are usually regarded as risk-free. Large cap stocks move up and down every day. So because government bonds is less risky, you would expect a higher or lower return?
Lower.
Lower. And that is why the government bond has a return here of 5%. And the large cap stocks have a return of 3 times the government bond. Now you can look down and see what happens to risk. The government bonds only have a variance of 100, whereas large cap stocks have a variance of 225. It means they are much more volatile than government bonds. The same thing is shown by standard deviation, and the standard deviation is just the square root of the variance, so that in the case where you have a variance of 100 for government bonds, the square root of 100 is 10. In the case where you have the variance of 225, the square root is just 15. The correlation is 0.5, meaning that they are related, not 100% related, but there is some degree of association between large cap stocks and government bonds. So this slide is basically just to show you the underlying relationships. Now this slide shows you and partially answer the question that Aloysia was asking, because this slide shows you both return and risk. And it shows you what happens when you combine the two securities, that is large cap stocks and government bonds. If you look at the first slide, let's make it a lot nicer. Let me just get it out. If you look at this slide, you'd realize, look over in the weight column, you'd realize that if you have your whole, one being 100%, so that if you have your whole portfolio in government bonds and you have zero in large stock, you'll get the expected return of 5%. Everybody follows that? Notice that if you have that, your portfolio standard deviation would be exactly 10. Why do you think it would be exactly 10, based on what we did before? Because from the slide before, we calculated that government bonds had a variance of 100 and a standard deviation of 10. So if you put your whole portfolio in government bonds, then what it means is that the portfolio variance would be exactly equal to the variance for government bonds, 110 standard deviation, because all of the portfolio, there's no large cap securities in it. All of it is in government bonds. Everybody follows that? If you go right down to the last one, the last row, This is the exact opposite, where you have all of the investment is in large cap, none is in government bonds. And so that you will see that the portfolio variance is 225, which is the exact portfolio variance for large cap stocks, because there's no bonds in that folio. Now, if you move, go back to the top from five, but right up to the top row, as you begin now to increase, let's look at the large cap stocks. You have zero in the first row, then 0.1, then 0.2, 0.3, and it goes up. As you begin to increase the large cap stocks, give it a higher percentage of the portfolio, what happens to your variance? What happens? You're increasing your large cap stocks. What happens to your variance?
Decreases.
We should go up. Let me see if this is right. Yeah, it is going up. Yeah, it is going up. As you increase your, if you, as soon as you increase it, it keep going up from a hundred, from, well, it go down initially, but no, something is wrong here. But it should go up, because as, now the thing about market data though, is that sometimes market don't exactly follow the theory. But what should happen is that you should expect that as you increase the percentage of large cap stock, you increase your risk, and the portfolio variance, as well as the portfolio standard deviation, would also go up. Because, and that is, but what would also happen is that your return will also go up. As the risk goes up, your return go up, because large cap stocks are much more risky than government bond, although they carry a significantly more risk. So that how it should really work out in practice or in theory is that as you increase the percentage of large cap stocks, what should happen? Your risk should go up, but your return should also go up. And you see the return going up here. You see the risk going up, not exactly linearly, but you also see the risk going up here in the portfolio variance column. And vice versa. The more bonds you have, if you have a whole lot of bonds, then your risk would be smaller, but your return would be smaller. And that is what this slide is intended to show. This is the efficient frontier shown graphically. And when you do a finance course, in fact, most of the work is done on graph, but I've tried to avoid getting too mathematical and to focus on your understanding and using them. When you look at this graph, on the horizontal axis, you see the variance. And when on the vertical axis, you see the expected return. Now, one of the assumptions of portfolio theory is that risk and return completely define the security. You don't need any other information. So here you have the variance, which is a measure of risk, and the expected return, which is a measure of return. And that tells you everything you need to know about these securities. Now, if you look at this, and this efficient frontier have been developed, that is the shape it takes, and that shape comes from a whole lot of portfolio theory. But why is this the efficient frontier? Because if you look, let's go to the other slide where we break it down. You see the red mark, or is it purple or brown? You see the brown portfolio? Do you see the brown dot?
Yeah.
Everybody sees it?
Yeah.
Now, let us assume you choose that. Let us assume you choose that. That is off of the frontier, because the frontier is the curve. So let's assume you decide to choose that portfolio. What would happen here? What it would mean here, look at it.
Too much risk for the level of return.
That's correct. It means that you could have gone and get a security, the one going up vertically, that has a higher return at the same level of risk. So that move up, you're at the brown one, move up to the blue one, up, going up vertically. And you see the portfolio that is on the frontier? Compare those two. You'd recognize that it has a much higher return, Can you see my cursor?
Yes.
Okay. This is the one. Let's assume you select this. And let's compare it with this one. At this one, this is the return level for it. Go over here to the axis, that's the return level. This one, the return level is over here. So you're saying if you chose this one, you'll get a higher return. But both of them have the same level of risk. So it would not make sense to choose this one because you could get a higher return without incurring any risk. Is that clear to everybody? If you look at it horizontally, it tells a similar story because horizontally, let's compare it with this other one that is on the portfolio. This other one have much lower risk. They have the same return, but this one that is on the line, it's supposed to be on the line, has the same degree of risk. Same return, sorry, you have a much lower risk, but the same degree of return. So you will choose this one because you want to reduce your risk at the same level of return. So that anything that is not on this line, anything that is not on this line is not efficient because you can find, if you have anything in here, you can find one on the line that will dominate it. That is, would have a higher return at the same level of risk or a lower risk at the same level of return. So that is why this line is deemed an efficient frontier, because all of these dominates all the others that are in the efficient set. That covers a lot of the theory. And like I said to you, this explaining this theory is a university course. It takes a little while, but what I hope I have done is to just give you a feel for it, and I hope that you will do some more reading and actually look at it's very mathematical too, and look at a mathematical derivations and the graph, but having an overview, you can understand the general principles that are entailed. What time do we break for lunch? You said there's a break at 10:15, you said? What time you said it was?
10:45 to 11 is the break.
10:45 to 11. Okay, let's continue. We're now looking at financial instruments and investment vehicles. And you can see they are listed here. Stocks, bonds, cash, real estate investment trusts, private equity, hedge funds. Asset allocation, I remember I said before that asset allocation is yield better results generally based on the theory that trying to time the market and select individual stocks at a particular time because you think it will go up or down. It involves distribution of wealth among different countries and asset class so that you could allocate your assets between various countries, or you could allocate it between the various asset classes, which is the asset classes we discussed here. It could be bond, stock, cash, real estate, investment trust, etc. Asset allocation is the dominant factor in portfolio performance. In other words, if you allocate properly, that would account for 90% of the return on a portfolio, of the performance of a portfolio. And it says here, the accepted paradigm is that more than 90% of an investor's return is attributable to how the assets are weighted across asset class, not how you time the market or how you choose individual securities or when you choose them. The implication of this is only 10% can be attributed to security selection, market timing, or other factors. And so that when you speak to many brokers, et cetera, they give you the impression that they are magicians. I don't know if you all watch CNBC, and there's a guy there, I forget what his name. He's a crazy guy, always telling you which stock to buy. That is not science, that's magic. The science of investing is to have fully diversified portfolio and choose and allocate your assets depending on the level of risk that you want to assume. I must admit, I like to follow the magic science myself, but you suffer significant losses as a result. And you have a little graph here which shows you where you get most of it. You get 90% of it from asset selection. You get 5% from market timing. You get 3% from selection. Other factors, 2%. But the big area is what the benefit you get from asset allocation. So that asset allocation is the key towards wealth creation when you're making investment decisions. We discussed this before. First of all, for you to determine in asset allocation, you have to speak to the investor. You have to determine his net worth, how much money he has. That is very important because utility theory has proven that risk is very, the level of risk aversion that a person have is dependent on the amount of wealth that he has. His willingness to take risk depends on the amount of wealth that he has. You have to look at his risk tolerance, his appetite to risk. And so they will ask you a lot of questions. Suppose you lost your whole portfolio. If fellow say, well, I will commit suicide, then it means that he that prepared to take all that risk. And you might ask him, suppose you lost half, suppose you lost a quarter. But when you ask them those type of questions, you begin to get a sense. You can't just ask them, what is your appetite for risk? Because everybody would say, yeah, man, I take risk. But when you begin to ask them the attitude to if they lose a particular asset, then it becomes a different question. So you have to ask them a whole series of questions that would give you a judgment as to how well they can tolerate risk. Then you have to look at the capital market conditions, the predictions, the expected return, risk, and correlation. Then they suggest that in order to choose the optimum portfolio, you should use an optimizer. What I have found with most investment banks now, or with most investment advisors, they don't use an optimizer. What they have three or four indices, or three or four portfolios with different risk profiles. And when they are able to determine your attitude to risk, they decide which one of them they can put you in, so that they may have one with all bonds diversified across internationally, so that if you don't want any risk at all, they may put you in that one. They may have one with all good stocks, so that if you're very risky, have a strong appetite for risk, they may put you in that one. If you want to take some risk but not too much risk, then they may put you in one with a combination of stocks and bonds. So that in practice, even though in theory you use an optimizer basically is to determine the mean variance efficient portfolio, which one gives you the maximum return for a given level of risk or the least risk for the game. You can use an Excel optimizer and get that. But in practice, when you're dealing with them, they develop four or five set of portfolios and they just advise you to go into one of them depending on your risk profile. And then there's feedback into the process. What would happen is that every 6 months or every year, the investment professional should call the investor, discuss the performance, how the particular portfolio is performing. Is it meeting his expectations? Give some projections of where it's likely to go and make any adjustment as you go along. So this is the step that you would follow. How do you, there are various ways to allocate assets, and you do have what they call strategic asset allocation, and they have tactical asset allocation. In strategic asset allocation, there are long-term goals. So a person may come in, and you, one of the things you will ask them when they come in is, how long you want to invest this money for? Do you have any big expenses coming up over the next year or two that would require you? Or is this just the money you're putting aside for retirement and you have other resources to live? So that if you are looking very long-term, then this sort of allocation would probably suit you, because this is based on long-term goals. Like, you may want to retire and you want to make sure you have enough money to retire. Some people want to leave some money for their children, and they may tell you up front, yeah, I'm investing this now, but I need to leave $2 million for my children. And you could decide whether or not they should probably set up a specific fund that would grow to that at a particular point in time. Employ long-run capital market conditions. And it looks at capital market conditions over the very long term. I am not very optimistic about this approach. I don't even know how the market will be tomorrow, much less to say how it will be 20 years from now. But you have a duty to look at broad macroeconomic indicators and to decide what would market conditions be down the road. Relatively few asset classes would be considered. And as I said before, if you have bond and stock, provided the stock is in a broad index, like the market index, you can combine bond and stock in a manner that allow you to achieve the objectives. You don't have to go and to look at a whole lot of other type of investment classes. Those two alone should allow you to achieve the objective that you want to achieve. Investors are asked to choose from a range of outcomes and risk after optimization process. Basically, in the real world, the investors will be asked to look at various funds that they have with different risk profile and return profile, and choose which one they think, and they will show them the actual performance over the last 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, and ask them which one they think would best suit their needs. Provide useful benchmark in normal times as conditions change, consider alterations. Even in a strategic allocation process, sometimes conditions change dramatically and you have to alter the allocation. And that is why it's very important that at least on an annual basis, you meet with the client and you actually decide how best, whether or not it is meeting their needs. Or sometimes the client's objectives change. Sometimes their circumstances and their objectives change. And so that you could make alteration as you go along. Tactical allocation. Asset allocation based on mean reversion of equity and bond risk premium. Basically, this is what they call a hybrid strategy, in the sense it is not an active strategy, but it has some amount of trading in it. It is based on the premise that it is bond and equity sometimes are overpriced, but they would always go back to their mean. And so that you can, even though you have an ideal allocation, like X amount in bond, X amount in stock, that sometimes they vary that to take advantage of an opportunity. But at some stage in the process, they go back to the preliminary allocation. If they decided they want 40% in bond and 60% in stock, if they see great opportunities in bond, they may actually increase the percentage of bond. But they're also of the view that those opportunities are short term. So over the long term, they will try to get back to the allocation that meets the need of the client. Of course, for them to do that, they would have to have a discretionary mandate, so that whenever you have an investor come to you, you would have to sign, they would sign giving you discretion over how you allocate the portfolio. So that, and that discretion would be very specific. Like, you could say that although I want 40% in bond, you have the right to go up to 45% if you want to take advantage of an opportunity, or you have the right to go down to 35% if you feel that the bond market are going to be to my disadvantage. It is performed routinely, which means that on a daily routine basis, they have to check up on that security. It is not like the strategic ones, once they decide the allocation, sometimes they don't even look at it until a year or two after, until the time come up for a discussion. Of course, because they're in the market, if something radical is happening, they would be aware of it and probably look at it. But the basic premise is that you take a very long-term view. It assumes investors' risk tolerance constant, focus on changing capital market output, so that they assume that your risk tolerance is constant. That is not necessarily true, because sometimes your circumstances change and your whole attitude to risk change. But that is the assumption, and if that has changed, it is for the investor to come to you and say, "Boy, you know, I have to now begin to worry about my retirement and getting really nervous about the market circumstances, and I would like to change it." In the case of active bond portfolio, this is active. You trade almost every day because you believe that some bonds are overvalued, some are undervalued, and so you enter the market to get bargains on those that are undervalued, and you sell those that you think are overvalued. So that, of course, you know, bonds, based on what we discussed yesterday, bonds are very sensitive to interest rates. So that they will sit and they will decide, is the interest rate going to go up or down? If the interest, remember what we said yesterday, when interest rate goes up, what will happen to bond prices? Anybody remember that? They would go down. So that if you believe that interest rate is going up and so bond prices is going down, then you might actually begin to unload some of your bonds now, because you expect prices to go down in the hope that when it goes down, you could buy them back. Valuation analysis, it also involves valuing your bonds on an ongoing basis to determine if they're undervalued or overvalued, and adjusting your portfolio. Credit analysis, that involves looking at the various ratings for the issuers, and even between the ratings, looking at issuers, any news items about the issuers, and adjusting your portfolio depending on how much faith you have. For example, if you have government bonds, and at the end of the year you heard a budget with some huge deficit figure which they never had before, and you deem it is unsustainable, then that might affect how much of that government bonds that you actually want to have. Yield spread analysis, and we'll discuss this a little more. It has to do with looking at the spread over various maturity or the spread across a particular risk group. But we will discuss that a little, and bond swaps. So as we go into the other slides, you'll see exactly what we're speaking about. Active bond portfolio management strategies. We discussed a little bit about interest rate expectation strategies. It involves sitting down, making a judgment as where you think interest rate will go, and adjusting your portfolio accordingly. For example, if you went into the market now, most people are predicting that interest rate will go up, because interest rates have been historically very low. The monetary conditions and cash conditions are tightening in the US and globally. Central banks' balance sheets are swollen. They are too big because they went into a very loose expansionary policy for a long time, and they need to rein them back in. So most people are predicting that you will have increases in interest rate over time. And so that means they are predicting that the value of bonds will go down. And so that will have implication for their strategy. the change in the shape of the yield curve will affect whether or not you go to the short end of the market or to the long end of the market. What is the yield curve? Generally, you expect a yield curve that goes like that. It discussed the yield curve reflects the relationship between the maturities of the securities and the returns. So you would expect that you have long-term securities you would generally get a higher return for that, because long-term securities, you have much more risk. But sometimes that doesn't happen. Sometimes you have a flat yield curve where you're getting a 5% return for a 20-year security, but you're also getting a 5% return for a 5-year security, so that it is flat. And so an investment analyst will take advantage of that, and they'll probably want to be at the shorter end, if they believe that the that the yield curve will go back to its normal shape. Changes in yield spread across bond sectors. You have different bond sectors. You have government sectors, you have corporate bonds, and usually if you are involved in investment, you will know what is the difference in price between a corporate bond and a government bond, for example. And if you feel all of a sudden that the difference is too narrow, the difference usually should be about 5%, assume, and all of a sudden it is 2%, you may feel that it has to revert to that 5% at some stage, so that you should intervene and seek to take advantage of that situation which you believe is temporary. Changes in yield spread, risk premium for a particular bond. If you feel like this is the same thing as saying that the intrinsic value of the bond is lower or higher than what it is trading for. And if you feel that the intrinsic value is higher than what it is trading for, then you'll buy more of the particular bond. All of these are various strategies related to active bond portfolio. What happens in this type of scenario? You're looking for opportunities on an ongoing basis. You're making judgment about markets, about interest rates, about the issuers, about whether or not they will default. And based on those judgments, you will adjust the portfolio allocation accordingly.
Okay, Mr. Lawrence, maybe we can take
a break now.
Take a break, and we will be back in
15 minutes.
Yeah, at 11 o'clock. 11 o'clock?
Yeah, 11 that's good.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we should log off? Aloysia or Sam?
You can stay on, just unmute your mic. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, it's 11:05. We're back. I will assume that everybody is on. So let me just do a quick call through. Cassandra Richardson. Okay, she's on that. Maurice Horn. Suzette Anthony.
I'm here.
Nikisha Pemberton. Bianca.
I'm here.
Beverly Green. Okay, so we're missing three people, it sounds like. Cassandra, are you with us? Okay, so we'll continue and they will join us when during the presentation. Okay, over to you, Mr. Lawrence. So, mic is muted.
Yeah, you hear me now? Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, we were discussing active bond portfolio management strategies. And one of them we said was interest rate expectation strategies. So we'll go into a little more detail about interest rate expectation strategies. Do you remember yesterday we spoke about bond duration and how to interpret bond duration? I hope everybody recalled that discussion. This is very critical in the interest rate expectation strategy. It involves altering the bond sensitivity to interest rate changes, duration, based on assessment of the direction of interest rate. And I discussed that previously. Basically, a bond with a high duration would be very, very sensitive to changes in the interest rate. A bond with a low duration would not be very sensitive to changes in interest rates. So that if you expect interest rates to go up, then you will be investing more in bonds with low duration, because you would want to protect yourself against those rises, those big shifts in your portfolio values based on a change in interest rate. If you expect interest rates to go down, you'd want to benefit fully from the increases in bond prices. And so you will go to bonds with higher duration. And remember, we also distinguished yesterday between the maturity of a bond and the duration of a bond. And these are said here. If interest rates are expected to fall, the duration of the portfolio is increased by buying and allocating greater weights to long-term bonds. If vice versa, if interest rates are expected to rise. If the benchmark index is a bond portfolio, usually when you engage an investment manager, he has a benchmark index, and that benchmark index is what is used to judge his performance, so that he's expected to perform. The benchmark could just be the Russell, or it could be any index, any bond index. And If the benchmark is a bond portfolio, then expectations of falling interest rates will involve increasing duration relative to benchmark portfolio. When you have a benchmark portfolio, you're expected to do as good as the benchmark. And so the benchmark portfolio will have a specific duration and it would have a specific expected returns, et cetera. But if, for example, you expect interest rates to go up, then you would expect that your duration would be less than the benchmark. And if you expect interest rate to go down, you'd expect that your bond duration will be above the benchmark, so that you would adjust your duration relative to the benchmark. Interest rate strategies. Portfolio's duration may be altered by swapping bonds in portfolio with new bonds that will achieve the target duration. So that if you have bonds, a lot of bonds with duration of 10, and you want to go short end of the market, you simply sell those bonds and buy instead bonds with a duration of 2. So you swap out all of the bonds you had for 10 with a duration of 10 and buy for a duration of 2. The key is the ability to correctly forecast the direction of future interest rates. If you get that wrong, then your bond strategy will not work. For example, you may expect an increase. That is why there's so much interest every month as to where the Fed will go with interest rates. Because bond managers in particular, bond portfolio managers in particular, are directly affected by changes in the interest rate. If the Fed goes up, then the value of bonds go down. So that they would want to anticipate, and so that if they expect the Fed to go up, they would buy bonds with low duration, so that even though the value of the bonds go down, it wouldn't be too much, because with low duration, the bonds are not very sensitive to changes in interest rate. Yield curve strategies, positioning portfolio to take advantage of expected change in the shape of the Treasury yield curve. Again, I told you the yield curve basically is a curve that shows the relationship between maturities and yield. Generally, you'll expect that the higher the maturity, you'll expect the higher the yield. But if you're anticipating shifts in the curve, and those shifts could be either parallel or they could be non-parallel, then you will have to adjust your portfolio accordingly. Because when interest rate goes up or down, sometimes it affects the short end of the market more than it affects the long end of the market. And that will depend on the shape of the yield curve. And so that an understanding of the yield curve is very important in terms of deciding what would be your asset allocation. Bullet strategy, portfolio constructed so that maturities of the securities in the portfolio are highly concentrated at one point on the yield curve. If, for example, you feel that the yield curve is going to shift in a way that it is more advantageous to have long-term securities, then what you will do is that you will probably start swapping out short-term securities for long-term security and vice versa. And so that a lot of your securities would be focused or would be concentrated at one end of the yield curve, either the long end or the short end. You can have a barbell strategy where you divided them up between the long end and the short end, and you leave the middle there, so that the middle securities, you don't have much in there, or you have a lot at the short end, a lot at the long end. So whichever way interest goes, you have some advantage. It's basically a diversification strategy, because if it shifts in favor of short term, then the short term will do well, but the long term will not do so well. If it shifts in favor of long term, the long term will do well, but the short term will not do well as well. And so it would counter one another and actually protects you against changes in the yield curve. Other people use a completely different strategy, which is the ladder strategy. So they put equal amounts in various maturities. So they would have 1/3 at the short end of the market, 1/3 at the middle end of the market, and another 1/3 at the long end of the market. Positioning portfolio to capitalize on expected changes in yield spreads, and we discussed that already in more detail. Yield spread strategies, we have discussed some of that already, but they involve exchanging one bond for another under the assumption that prevailing spreads are out of line with historical spreads, so that if you feel that prevailing spreads are out of line with historical spreads and that those spreads are going to go back to historical spreads, then you position yourself to take advantage of the change when it actually changed back to historical spreads. Yield spreads will realign to historical levels during the investment horizon. That is, you're expecting that the yield spread will go back to historical levels. Substitution swap, exchanging one bond for another that is similar in terms of coupon, maturity, credit quality, but have a higher yield. This is almost like arbitrage in the sense that you have two bonds. They have the same coupon. They have the same maturity. They are all AAA rated, so they have the same credit quality, but one have a higher yield than the other. You would actually move towards getting the bonds with the higher yields. Credit spread, that changes with economic conditions. And what credit spreads have to do with is that we discussed yesterday the various ratings, bond ratings, like AAA, AA, etc. Usually there's a spread between the various ratings so that a AAA would have a lower yield than a AA. A double A would have a lower yield than a BBB. And so notice when I spoke about spread before, I was talking about the relationship between yields and maturity. In this case, you're concerned about the relationship between yields and the credit rating or the credit quality. And again, what happens here, if some people think those yields are too narrow and they're going to go back to historical trend at some stage, then they begin. If they feel, for example, that the spread between AAA and AA is too narrow, then it means they expect it to widen. They expect the spread to widen, then it means that they will probably start to invest in AA, in the lower risk security. So a lot of this is very complicated, and you get to understand it a little more when you're actually working with them on a day-to-day basis. But this gives you a feel of how active you have to be when you are actually trading securities and when you are actually managing a portfolio on behalf of clients. Indexing. A lot of people prefer to do this. They will just seek to match the performance of the index. And so the investment manager will simply mimic the index, so that he may actually buy all of the stocks in a particular index and buy them in the same proportion in which they exist in the index. So whatever the index does, they do. Of course, he doesn't have to do that now, because you do have what they call exchange traded funds, and they have index funds. So if you buy in an index fund that mimic, say, the S&P 500, then your performance would be exactly like the S&P 500. It is low cost and easy to implement. You don't have to do anything. You just have to readjust the portfolio occasionally to make sure that the proportions are exactly in line with the proportions in the index. But you can have what they call enhanced indexing. Even though you're mimicking the index, they might give you some flexibility to move away from the index on occasion and take advantage of some profits. And they call this enhanced indexing. For example, I'll give you one strategy in terms of enhanced indexing. Sometimes, even though you have an index and you're mimicking the index, you may feel that some stocks in the index are going to do really bad. So instead of mimicking the whole index, you'll mimic the index except for those stocks. Or you may feel that the index does not reflect some stocks which you think are going to do very well, and you could add them to the index stock so that you use the index as a reference point and you add or subtract stocks with a view to enhancing the returns on the index. That's not the only way by which you could enhance index returns, but those are the type of adjustments you will do in order to enhance the index. Then there's immunization. Some people are saving for a fixed amount. They want to get $100,000 at the end of 5 years. And they know interest rate is going up and down. They would want to immunize their bond from changes in interest rate. And so the portfolio, the manager would select a portfolio that would guarantee them that they would, at the end of 5 years, it would be $100,000. There are numerous ways of doing that. Basically, what you'll try to do is to match the maturities with the investment horizon of the investor. Or the easiest way to do it is to buy the zero coupon bond. So a person wants to make $100,000 in 5 years' time. You buy zero coupon bonds at, say, $75, and you leave it invested. At the end of 5 years, there's no interest or anything in between. At the end of 5 years, you get $100,000. Of course, if you try to sell it before the 5 years up, you could suffer. You could get either a gain or you could suffer a loss. But immunization is really an attempt to protect the security from changes in interest, so that at the end of the day, you get exactly what you're saving towards. Equity portfolio management. And so we're moving from bonds into equity. And this shows you some of the methods they use, top down versus bottom up, technical analysis versus fundamental analysis, market strategies based on fundamental analysis, market strategies based on technical analysis, key performance measures, performance measurements in the OECS markets. Let's move on. And this is just a list of some of the activities of the portfolio manager. This is a very, very important activity. The first one, data collection and analysis, industry review and analysis, security valuation and recommendation, security allocation within portfolio limits. A lot of this data collection analysis and industry review and analysis, a lot of companies subscribe to Bloomberg. And so they would, or other similar, Standard & Poor's, they have a similar service. And you have some cheaper ones too. That would give you a lot of information that allows you to do this. You would have to have a platform for trading, and you do have a whole lot of brokers, online brokers, that allows you to trade. And the distinguish here between program trading and individual transaction. Program trading is when you have developed a strategy and you put a set of rules within a computer that says if the stock falls below 10% of some benchmark, then sell. If it goes above X percent, then buy. So that the investment manager doesn't have to intervene. The computer will make a determination, will keep calculating every day to see where the stock falls in relation to the benchmark, and it will just trade or sell. In fact, this is one of the reasons that has created a lot of volatility and has been responsible for some of the stock exchange crisis in recent times. Because what has happened is that all of a sudden, all the computers are selling at the same time. Because all of them have reached a particular benchmark and they begin to sell like crazy. and they do it almost instantaneously, and within minutes, the stock market takes a 10% fall. By the time people go back to look at these programs and see what happened, trillions of dollars have been wiped off the value, the market capitalization. So that right now, in a lot of stock exchanges, there are very strict rules in relation to program trading. And there are rules as to when you shut down trading. For example, if prices drop below a certain value within a certain time frame, then trading just stops, because they understand that the computers will start to get into the system and start to create havoc in the system. Enhanced indexing, we have done that. We've discussed that. Style analysis, and that is where we look at the style of different people, like the Warren Buffets and other people of that nature. Portfolio monitoring, portfolio performance relative to benchmarks, we have discussed that. Compliance to investment policy and regulatory requirements, especially for institutional investors, most of them have very clearly defined investment policy, and they would usually have a compliance department, and that compliance department will be examining the portfolio on an ongoing basis and examining the performance of the manager on an ongoing basis to make sure that they fully comply with the terms of the agreement that they have between the institution and the investment manager. And they would also ensure that there's compliance with regulatory requirements, because take, for example, a bank have very, very clear regulatory requirements about how much our insurance company, how much they can invest in short term, how much they can invest in long term, how much they can invest in equity, etc. And so that you will have that element, especially if you're working with institutional investors. In our performance measurement for investment managers, and there are various tools that they use to measure the performance of investment managers. I will discuss a few a little later on. This is how you evaluate securities. And the first approach is a top-down approach, where you start with a micro and macroeconomic analysis. You understand the environment. And once you're on the relationships in that environment, how does interest rate changes affect stock? How does inflation affect stock? How does growth affect stock value? What are the predictions? The government budget. Do you think, for example, in the US now, there's a whole fiscal stimulus program, and people are predicting that fiscal stimulus program will have an impact on growth. There's also a whole tax reform program, which they think would also increase growth. Those are some of the considerations that you will take into account in that top-down approach. And this starts first. The top-down approach suggests that you look at the broad picture first before you drill down and begin to look at the specific security. Having looked at the economy as a whole, you move down and look at the industry. And you select the best industries within the economies, so that you have done your analysis, you understand what will happen for the economy as a whole, and you say which industries are likely to benefit most or to be protected most from the economic circumstances that you predict in the wider economy. Then you move down from the industry into the company, and you select the best companies with the best prospects in the selected economies and industries. For example, if you have a certain type of industries, traditionally, if you expect growth to be slow or that you're going to have a recession, some people go into defensive securities like utilities, whether or not, or they might go into food or into pharmaceuticals. I mean, if you get sick, you have to buy drugs, whether or not the economy bad or the economy good. And so those would be the type of defensive action that they would take. Above provides substantial information for stock valuation and selection. It involves a lot of logic and empirical support. And that is very important. It doesn't matter. This is not fact-based. Yes, you will get facts. You will look at financial statements. You look at economic performance, etc. And but at the end of the day, you have to form an opinion. And so, and you have to apply logic in terms of making a determination as to how you will invest the resources of the investor. Bottom up is different. It starts mainly from, well, not start. It starts and stays. It goes and look at the company itself right away and look at company factors without spending too much time looking at the macroeconomic and industry issues. It involves selection of undervalued stocks with potential for generating above market returns. It de-emphasizes the significance of economic and industry factors. And it focuses on analysis of individual companies and their securities. This is an approach that, honestly, people do it. I don't recommend it because I do not believe that companies exist in a vacuum. Companies exist in an environment. They exist in an industry. They exist in a company. And they exist in a country. And the performance of the company is bound to be affected by those issues. Fundamental analysis. There are two broad types of analysis people carry out in terms of securities. One is fundamental analysis and the other is technical analysis. With fundamental analysis, you try to get an understanding of the company. With technical analysis, you try to get an understanding of how price have moved in the past under the assumption that past price movements give you an indication or give you some hint as to what will happen in the future. So you don't have to understand anything about the company. You just have to look at charts showing you how prices have moved, and that will give you an indication of the direction prices will take in the future. The fundamental analysis starts with available public material information. So you'll get all the information that is published about the company. And that is important. If you have companies, especially if you are in the OECS and you have listed companies, it's good for you to get a copy of their annual accounts as a starting point so that you could understand, you could start there. Historic analysis, a single year company's account, useful. But it is far better if you are able to make comparisons with previous years and to follow trends. So you need to look at the historical pattern. You select an appropriate valuation model for dividends and cash flow projections. This is a very fundamental issue in terms of any security you buy. You have to have a sense of the value of the shares. And the value of the shares is dependent on a number of factors. One of them is profitability and the cash flow that the enterprise will generate in the future. The other is the riskiness of the enterprise. If you're able to get those two factors, you are able to provide a rough idea of the value of the securities, because there's what you call a dividend valuation model, where you look at all the future expected cash flows and you discount them to get the value of the firm. But that discount rate must include some understanding of the risk, must take into account the risk of the particular enterprise. And it will differ from enterprise to enterprise, because each enterprise will have a different risk premium. Stock valuation, it determines the intrinsic value based on investors' required return. That investor's required return is what has in that risk premium. It is the risk-free rate plus the risk premium, as we discussed before, that investors want to receive to incentivize them to not just invest in government securities, but to incentivize them to take some risk and invest in the private sector. Overvalued or undervalued, current market price versus current valuation. So, that's the point. They would look at the current market price and they would look at how they value the enterprise. So the current market price for a stock might be 30. But when they value the enterprise is 40, then they say, okay, I believe this enterprise is valued at 40, but the current market price is 30, then I should be buying this stock. But putting a value on these shares requires fundamental analysis. Looking at all available public information, carrying out historic analysis, applying a dividend valuation model, and coming up with a value for the shares and comparing it to what? To the values that is being traded in the market currently. Again, the basic assumption is that over time, price will gravitate towards its intrinsic value. So that if you buy a share for $30, but the intrinsic value is 40 based on your models, then you're doing that because you expect over time it will go to its intrinsic value, its real value. It will move from the market price, it will move gradually to its intrinsic value. You're assuming there that the current price do not reflect all of the available information about the enterprise. And when that information comes to bear on the enterprise, the value will go up. If there's an efficient market hypothesis, though, where some people argue that prices always reflect all available information. And so they argue that investment managers cannot beat the market because prices already include all available information. Of course, it is a controversial area, and the whole practice of investment management is based on the premise that you could, in fact, beat the market. In terms of statistics, though, the statistic does not show investment managers beat the market. Some beat it and some don't beat it, but nobody beat the market consistently, which suggests that it's more a random process, which suggests that the efficient market hypothesis might actually be true and that the prices have all available information, and so it is difficult to actually beat the market. These are some famous fundamental analysts. Here is Ben Graham. I think he's perhaps the father of fundamental analysis. And the basic principles is margin of safety, in the sense that if he's going to buy a stock, it has to be X percent below the value. In other words, he does an intrinsic value and he decides the intrinsic value is $30, then the price must be X percent below the intrinsic value to give him some margin of safety. He's based primarily on long-term earnings. He believes that you shouldn't just trade in securities and treat securities as an asset in itself. You should trade as an owner. And in the same way, the owner of an enterprise will take interest in the enterprise, understand the enterprise. That is the same way you should treat stocks. And you should not overpay for growth. Growth stocks, especially those internet stocks, get a huge price bump because people expect them to grow very rapidly. If you look, for example, at Amazon right now, everybody are of the view that Amazon will grow very dramatically over time. The only risk that Amazon probably have is regulatory risk. They view that because they're literally outpacing everything and everybody, that regulators will start paying attention to them. But growth stocks get a huge price. He's saying that don't overpay for growth. In other words, he's not the person who would like the popular stocks. He believes sometimes those popular stocks are overvalued. These are some of his sister's philosophies: buy for less than 2/3 of its net asset value and focus with stocks and low PE ratio. Okay, what does this mean? The net asset value is what you get from the accounts, from the financial accounts. So that when you go in the financial accounts and financial account is a historical record. It really doesn't say much about true value, but Graham uses it. He says, go to the financial accounts, calculate the net asset value, and if you can buy a stock, you have to make sure that it's no more than 2/3 the price of the net asset value as reported in the financial statement. He also says that you should focus on stocks with low price earnings ratio. The price earnings ratio is the price that you're paying per unit of earnings. And let me give you an example. A shop said that, let's assume a stock has an EPS of 10, that is an earnings per share. So each share in this company is earning $10, but the price is $30, then it has a price earnings ratio of 3, because the price is 3 times the earnings per share. Now, usually, companies that people have a whole lot of confidence will grow in the future will have a high price earnings ratio. So that, in fact, the price ratio.
Excuse me, Mr. Lauren.
Sure.
Can you repeat that? I lost connection. Can you repeat the price earnings
ratio? Okay,
yes.
I was saying that the price earnings ratio is the price of a stock as a ratio of its earnings per share. And the example that I gave was that if the earnings per share of a company is $10 and it is trading for $30, then it has a price earnings ratio of 3, meaning that the price is 3 times the earnings per share. So that when you buy that share, you're getting the equivalent of 3 years' earnings. Is that clear? I'm also saying that that price earnings ratio is also a good indicator of future growth of the enterprise, because a company that has very high growth prospects would have a high price earnings ratio. So that in the markets now, a lot of companies are trading at 15, 20, but you'll find that Apple and Microsoft may trade at 40, at a price earnings ratio of 40, because people believe that they have good prospects for growth in the future. Ben Graham is saying that if you have to choose, it's better you choose stocks with low price earnings ratio, and that you should not overpay for growth. So a lot of those companies with high PE ratios, there's an overpayment for growth. It doesn't mean you can't buy a company with a high PE ratio, but it means you have to carry out a detailed analysis to make sure that you're not overpaying for growth. This is another rule he applies. Stock price must be equal to half of its previous market high. So if a stock price used to trade for, was at a high of $120 at some stage in its life, then you should not be paying, any stock that dropped below $60, that means half of its highest market price, then that is a stock that you should begin to look. Now, these are rule of thumbs. There's no theory, there's no logic. Ben Graham applied these based on his experience in the market. Other people and other investment managers would apply different rules. Another famous investor is Warren Buffett. And he's very similar to Graham in the sense that he carried out a lot of fundamental analysis. He also, I noticed that he's 15% Fisher, which Fisher tend to be far more quantitative. And so he would also apply a lot of quantitative modeling in his approach. He used Graham's idea of margin of safety. He recommends mastery over emotions, because a lot of people trade stocks based on emotion. People argue that investors have a herd instinct, everybody rushing to buy a stock, so you get emotional and you go and buy it. He also believes you should look at the long term. You should identify good long term investment and manage the portfolio over the long term, so that a portfolio will have changes up and down every week, every day, every month. But your focus should not be trying to capitalize on those changes, because you cannot predict them in any way. But companies tend to have a long term trend, and that is what you should be looking at when you're deciding to make an investment decision. Appreciate economic returns as a result and owning a great business. Buy stocks as if you're buying a business. And this is the whole principle, that you don't just buy stock based on the consideration for the stock. Look at this. If I was buying this business, would I consider this to be a good business? What are the factors would I take into account in determining whether or not I should buy this business? And those are the type analysis. The same analysis that you carry out for buying a business is the same analysis you're carrying out for buying a stock. Because stock ownership is actually giving you ownership in the business. A small portion, but it certainly gives you ownership in the business. These are some general rules that have been observed in the market over time. Small stocks generally outperform larger stocks. There have been a lot of theories as to why this happens, but this is this, and you'd find that many investors will try to make sure that there's some small stocks in their portfolio because of the fact that historically they have outperformed larger stocks. There are some stocks that are neglected. They're not in the news. They're not popular. And you need to pay attention to them because they may have some inherent value that you can take advantage of. You need to follow large inside ownership. For example, if you find that the people who are managers and who should know everything about this company, they are suddenly buying up stocks in that company, that should give you a warning that they expect something coming up shortly that can increase the price. And so a lot of people keep track of what the insiders are doing and try to follow the insiders. Of course, the insiders also know that people are following them so that they can behave in a way to fool the people who follow them also. You must show strong financial flexibility, and strong financial flexibility suggests that you must have low debt equity ratios. A company may be growing rapidly, but if it is growing rapidly on the basis of debt, in a recessionary period, or if there's any hiccups in the economy, those are the first company that go on under, because their debt is inflexible. They have to pay their debt. They have to pay their debt, have to pay the interest, have to pay the principal, whether or not the economy is performing, whether or not they have sales or they don't have sales. That remains as a burden over their head. And so that whenever you're evaluating a company, that debt equity ratio is a very important ratio, because it tells you who are likely to go under first if you have a recession. The low PE ratios in deciding who to invest in, which company to invest in, pay attention to low PE ratios, strong management, and competitive position. Earnings surprises are the difference between forecasted and actual earnings. Abnormal returns from stocks expected to provide positive earnings surprise. The thing about stock movement, if there's news about a stock and this is established, if everybody already know it, it's not going to move the price. What moves the price of a stock is a surprise. And so that people try to select, I don't know how they do it, but they try to select stocks that have the greatest potential for upward surprises. Of course, downward surprises could be a significant negative also. But many people feel, look, this company, people have not been paying attention to that. It's a drug company. They're doing some work in cancer. When you pay attention to the cancer, when you look at what they're doing, you believe they have a good chance of succeeding ahead of everybody else. And that would be a surprise, maybe a surprise. Then what you need to do is pay attention to it. And that is an area that you could invest in, because surprises does move stocks. Low price earnings. Price to earnings measure growth opportunities, and we have discussed that. High PE may represent excess premium for hard to forecast growth. And this is saying that, yes, growth companies have high PE, but some of it may not be real. Some of it may be just because you're unable to forecast what growth is, and so that you're actually overpaying for growth prospects. Low price earnings ratio, low PE, high quality companies are unlikely to provide negative earnings surprise. So that if they already have low PE, but they are high quality, and that's what you should be aiming for, those with low PE, so that the price is low relative to the earning, and they are high quality, they have good manager, they have a good competitive position. so that the likelihood that you'll have a negative earnings surprise is minimal. We're covering a lot of material in a very short period of time. So I want you to take some time. And it's important also to understand, a lot of people you hear on the TV programs, they are not economists and finance experts. They have paid attention to news for so long that they begin to understand the relationships between the key variables. And they begin to learn what the importance of PE, price earnings ratio, they begin to learn from just listening. And that's a very important aspect. When you start listening to news in relation to investment, or you listen to Bloomberg, CNBC, or one of those companies, maybe the terms will seem difficult to you, and they usually have up a whole lot of chat. But if you keep doing it consistently, you'll begin to understand fully, and you'll be surprised how knowledgeable you become of stock. If you're going to be in the investment management, if you're going to be in brokerage, if you're going to be in the finance industry, you have to be alert. You have to be up to date. You have to understand the terms. And so it is very critical that you pay close attention to those books. Every day, you should make it your business to read at least one financial periodical. So that every day, you read the Financial Times. That's what I read, actually. I like the Financial Times. Or you read the Wall Street Journal. And if you do that, even if you get a summary of what they're saying and how the market is performing, et cetera, how the actions of President Bush are going to affect President Trump going to affect the market. And you follow up that in the evening, if you feel like you want to watch some TV, you watch the TV. If you do that over a 6 months period, you'll be surprised at how knowledgeable. All the notions of duration, price earnings ratio, you're going to hear them so often that even without going through all the definitional issues, you'll begin to understand, get a sense of what they mean. Technical analysis, and we're coming close to the end. But this afternoon, what we will do is that we will go over, we'll finish up what we did yesterday, and then I'm going to give you some information in relation to a case. Just some basic information, and what it will be is that you will get the circumstances of an investor, and they expect you to kind of give some advice as to how you would advise the particular investor, and we will have a discussion with it. Just remember, there's no concrete or definitive way. Different advisors will advise different things, but whatever you advise just have to be logical. Technical analysis. The focus of technical analysis is on past performance of the price itself. They are not interested in the company. They are not interested in the economy. They are interested in how price have moved in the past. And their view is that if they have an understanding of how price can have moved in the past, that could give them signals as to when and buy securities. They're not concerned with intrinsic value. They're not worried about whether it is how to value the stock. They believe that past movements in price give hints as to where price will go in the future. Trend and momentum in price and volume data, they look for demand and supply of securities in the near term. So they believe demand and supply is what matters. People's emotion, whether or not people are comfortable with this stock and they want to demand it, or whether or not people are scared of this stock and they want to sell it. Trading rules are developed from past data, and the goal is to predict future based on past data. The thing about technical analysis is very short-term in orientation. They're worrying about price next tomorrow, next week, probably next month. They're very short-term in orientation. These are some of the basic principles. Market value of any good or service is determined by interaction of demand and supply, which is an economic principle. Supply and demand governed by both rational and irrational factors. And that is true. People buy stocks not just based on careful rationality, but people buy stuff based on the emotion and how they feel, and how they feel about Trump, how they feel about Obama, all of those factors. And so that is where a lot of the economic models fail to predict markets, because economic models are based primarily on rationality. The assumption is that actors, the human actors, are rational and they would always act in their best interest. But that is not necessarily true. And the technical analysts recognize that. And so they do not worry about all of the indifference curve of the investor and whether or not he can maximize the benefit, he can maximize the satisfaction he gets, things of that nature. Therefore, they look at the actual price, and based on the actual price, they make a determination as to how they expect future prices will go. Price generally move in trends. Trends change in reaction to shift in supply and demand. Shifts can be detected sooner or later. A lot of it is based on Dow theory. And Dow theory, I mean, that is where it started, where there's a whole view that that price moves in trend and that future prices reflect past price movement. Moving averages are a very important part of their armory. And I'm sure everybody there know how to do a moving average. If you're looking at price movement today, tomorrow, the price will be moving, will be very volatile. So that today might be $10, tomorrow $8, another day $15, etc. But if you look at the average over the last 200 days, then it tends to be smoother. And how you calculate, how you do that, you look at a moving average. How you look at a moving average, so you'll take the average over the last 200 days, and then tomorrow, you take the average over the last 200 days also. So you add tomorrow's price and you subtract the first one that you had. And every day you add a new price and you subtract the first one that you had. So that you always have a 200 average and it moves, but it moves far more smoothly and it doesn't have as much movement up and down. And that's a very important tool in technical analysis. They also use bar charting. They use an advanced decline index, which shows the number of stocks increasing in price relative to those decreasing. So if they look and they see the number, if they see that 50%, let's say 75% of the stock are increasing and only 25% are decreasing, then that to them indicate the possibility of a bullish market, that price will probably increase. There's no science behind it. It's just a set of rules that they use to be able to make prediction as to when and buy securities. Okay, this is one chart showing technical analysis. It has two charts on it. One of them, the very smooth one, is the 200-day average. This bumpy one is the 50-day average. And you predict that because the longer the average, the smoother it is. And they would pay attention to this chart. And they may come up with a rule like this, and this is one of the classic rules they use, that once the 50-day average crosses over the 200-day average, it means that's a buy signal. The truth is, some people may use, instead of using the 50-day average, they may use the 30-day average, or some people may use the 60-day average. The point is that technical analysis is very subjective. Everybody uses their own systems. But this is one of the rules that is very common, that when the 50-day average cross over the 200-day average line, then that's an indication that you're probably going to see in the beginning of a bullish market. I'm just giving you a feel for some of them. There is also a whole notion of support and resistance in technical analysis, so that they will develop a trend line. Sometimes this trend line is a moving average, and they decide, and this is called a support because it is a flow, but they decide that every time the stock reaches that level, it's going to start to increase again. And they've developed that line based on history. They look at the history of the stock over a very long period of time. They draw a trend line and they decide at this point, whenever the chart tend to get to this point, it begins to increase again. So this is called a support line. So that for technical analysts, they would begin to start buying the security when it touches the support line because they would expect the prices to increase. It says here, price range at which technicians expect substantial increase in demand for a stock. Price of a stock or market can trade at over a period of time without going lower. Stock or market stops dropping as buyers start outnumbering sellers. That's what they're saying, is that when you touch the support line, the buyers will begin to outnumber sellers. Can you understand that? Because price is going down, but as you keep going down, it begin to look more and more attractive to a lot of people who wasn't holding the stock down. It's going down, people begin to start buying. And they're saying at some point, so many buyers will come online that the price will start going up. We're out of the realm of science now, and we're into the realms of magic. But the truth is, a lot of people use technical analysis. The thing about so many people use technical analysis that they are able to predict price, not so much because the models are good, but they are self-fulfilling prophecies. Because if everybody using these same models and everybody believes this is a buy signal, then everybody would buy at the same time and the price will go up. Not because the model is good, but because everybody using the same model. There's also a resistance line where they feel that, so notice the support line is the floor and the resistance line is the roof, where they feel that every time the price goes up to that level, it starts declining again. All of a sudden, it goes up to that level, people suddenly want to sell it, people begin to start selling, and so the price starts going down. And the sellers become more than the buyers, and so the price starts going down. There's no logic I can give you in relation to them. Moving averages lines, decision to buy or sell based on movement of stock over an extended period of time, 200 days. We discussed that. Buy if price is some percentage above the moving average and sell if it is some percentage above below the average. Again, that's what some people do. Instead of looking for the 50-day line to cross the moving average, they say if price is 10% above the moving average, buy. If it is 10% below the moving average, sell. Advanced decline line. On any trading day, some stocks will advance above their previous close, while some will decline. The cumulative advance over a certain number of days minus the cumulative declines over the same number provide an idea of direction. So that if more stocks are advancing than declining, then that in itself should tell you that the makings, that a bull market is in the making. Relative strength ratios, that is the ratio of price of stock to some price index, which could be industry based or overall. So you look at the index and you decide what is the ratio of the price of this stock to the index. And you look at how it is changing relative to the index. If it is changing rapidly in relation to the index, you would say that the stock has momentum, and a stock that has momentum is a stock that you should begin to buy. High numbers means stock or industry is on an upswing. It has momentum. Then there's a short interest ratio. Number of shares sold short to average daily trading. Now let's discuss short trading just a little bit so that you can understand this point. Quite often, investors sell stocks that they don't have. So they would sell a stock and promise to deliver it in 30 days. In 30 days, they have to go and they get the money for it. They sell a stock for $30. Let's assume they sell a stock for $30. and they promise to deliver it in 30 days. They have sold it short because they are short of the stock. They don't have the stock. 30 days, they have to deliver the stock. They have to go into the market and buy the stock. Now, if the price is very high, for example, when they go into the market to buy the stock could be $100, but they would still have to buy it at $100. So if the price is very high, they will suffer a big loss. They will suffer a $70 loss because they now have to buy the stock to deliver it. And when they would pay $100 for it, while it is only trading for $30. So generally, if you have a lot of short traders in the market, short sellers, it means that they're expecting the price to fall. They expect to sell you for $30, but they expect that when they are ready to buy it, to give it to you, the price would only be $15. So that if you have a whole lot of people doing that, it means they are expecting price to go down so that when the time comes to deliver, they get $30 now for the security, but when the time comes to deliver the security, they could buy it on the market and they could only pay for $15. Of course, that is a high risk because it could be $1,000, it could be $2,000. But if they have confidence that the market is going to fall, they're going to do that. So this is one of the ratios. They look at the ratio of the number of shares sold short to the average trading volume. So that if a high percentage of shares are being sold short, they will assume that's an indication that a bearish market is in the making, that people are expecting prices to fall. So people are selling short because they expect 30 days from now, they will be able to buy those shares cheaply and deliver on their contract. These are some general comments about technical analysis. What the time is now? What time is it? Okay, we're good. I think we're on time. We'll finish. We'll finish by 12.
Yes, it's just about 7 minutes past 12. So
yes, we'll finish by 12:15 because we're almost through.
Okay.
Okay. Challenges in using technical analysis. Past price patterns sometimes are not repeated. There's no good reason to believe that the past is a good representation of the future. It is self-fulfilling because so many people use technical analysis. It works sometimes because of the fact that people are using it, but not because of the inherent logic of it. Success of trading rule encourages adoption. Defeating returns requires great deal of subjective judgment. Critical values for rules change over time. And that's the other point. It is very subjective. You see all the things I've discussed, some people use the support and resistance line. Some people use the moving average. Some people use 30-day moving average instead of the 50 or 60-day or the 180-day moving average. And so that is a whole lot of subjectivity in it. Of course, you have to bear in mind that using fundamental analysis also have some disadvantage. One of them is that your financial statement has very limited disclosures. And even with the best financial statements in the world, that you do have significant misstatements, you do have significant governance failures that affect your ability to trust financial statements. So that is a major issue in relation to using fundamental analysis. Okay, when you use fundamental analysis, you have to rely on those financial statements. Different firms sometimes use different accounting policies. With the adoption of IFRS, International Financial Reporting Standards, the intention really is to narrow that gap. But the IFRS is based not on rules, on principles. And to the extent that you apply principles rather than rules, I would expect that accounting policies will deviate even more, would diverge even more. One of the things with technical analysis, which you have over financial statement and fundamental analysis, is that it has a better gauge. You take more explicit consideration of psychological factors, like what buyers are thinking, what they are doing. If people are buying short, then that could indicate that there's some herd activity going on that's going to affect the stock. So when you rely on financial statement and that type of fundamental analysis, sometimes you lose that psychological factor. Because in truth and in fact, people are not always rational. And a lot of the fundamental analysis, a lot of economics assumes people are rational. Trading technical analysis accept people as they are and accept that people actually base their decisions on a lot of irrational, emotional type issues. Active equity portfolio management, market timing strategy. This is how you would actively manage a portfolio. You try to time the market. You try to decide, look, this is the best time to buy this. This stock going to go up from now. When this stock reaches a certain level, that is when you enter the market. It also involves day trading strategy, where you take profits every day. You look at the movements in the day and you buy and sell at the day. By the end of the day, you close out and tomorrow is a new day. So that you try to make profits every day based on your prediction of what will happen during the course of the day. That requires a tremendous amount of effort because you have to follow that stock all day long and make determination as to whether to buy or sell. This momentum investment strategy involves buying stocks on an upswing and riding on the curve. You have to identify when you're on an upswing and buy stocks at that time. And that's what you could do that by fundamental analysis. But the charts and what the technical analyst does is do that. They try to identify upswings and they try to buy stocks at that time. Then there's sector rotation, earnings momentum, and price momentum. Sector rotation has to do with rotating among the sectors so that you feel that some sectors are the technology sector is doing badly at this time, but the utility sector is going to do better. And so you rotate between the sectors depending on the relationship sometimes, if you identify that there's a relationship between the sectors. Then this is a passive equity portfolio management. That's what most people in the Caribbean do. They buy and hold. Long-term buy and hold strategy advocates portfolio stability and seek securities with no good management, fundamentals, and prospects, and hold them for the long term. Price dips are viewed as buying opportunities. And then there's also an indexing strategy, and we discussed that before, where you actually just buy an index or you buy an exchange-traded fund that mimics the index, and you just, whatever the index gets, you get. If you lose it, you lose. So you just fall. This is based on the efficient market hypothesis. It's based on the belief that investment managers cannot outperform the market. And because they cannot outperform the market, it is safer for you to just invest in the index. One of the things I must, okay, let me move on. These are some measures that you use to measure the performance of your investment manager. And they are based primarily on risk and return. They want to see, basically, if you're looking at measuring the performance of a portfolio, you want to see what return. You would assume that if a portfolio is returning 10% and another one is returning 15%, that the one that is returning 15% is doing better. But that is not necessarily true because you have to take into account risk. So some of these measures measure, like the Trainer Index and the Sharpe Index, measure return per unit of risk. And that is what they use to evaluate whether or not the manager is doing well. So they will get the risk-free rate. They will get the risk-free rate. Let's assume this risk-free rate is 10. And let's assume that their return is 16. So they're making 6% over the risk-free rate. So that they're doing very well because they're getting 6% over the risk-free rate. But what about risk? So that if their company have a beta of 2, it means they are making 3% per unit of beta. So that what, so that that model take into account both risk and return. They're looking at your excess risk per unit of beta. The difference between the Sharp index and the trainer index is that the trainer index use beta. That is, it use variability with the market, whereas the Sharp index use standard deviation, where it is looking at the risk, the total risk of the enterprise. Notice when you use beta, you're focusing just on the systematic risk, because they argue that investors would only pay for systematic risk, they would not pay for unsystematic risk. When you use Sharp index, which use standard deviation, they use per unit of total risk, which would be both systematic and unsystematic risk. So that the Sharp index have the beta, would have the standard deviation, whereas the trainer index would have the beta. And you could write down, it is the return on the portfolio. For the trainer index, is the return on the portfolio minus the risk-free rate. Divided by beta. And the Sharp index is the return on portfolio minus the risk-free rate divided by standard deviation, sigma. The Jensen index is a little more complicated. The Jensen index tried to measure what is called alpha. And let me explain that to you. Remember I told you that the value, the rate of return on a stock is equal to the risk-free rate plus a risk premium. Is that clear? Everybody remember that? Now, there's a model called the capital asset pricing model, which calculate what would be the expected return on a portfolio. And basically, it would be, the it says that the return is equal to the risk-free rate plus the risk premium, and it give a formula for calculating the risk premium. When you apply that formula, and let's assume you apply that formula, and your expected return, rate of return is 10%, but you are actually making 12%, then your alpha is 2%, because you're doing better than the expected return of 10%. So the Jensen alpha is based on the premise that when you use the CAPM model to calculate your expected return and you actually do better than that, then the difference between how you actually did and what the CAPM model predicted is called your alpha. Is that clear to everybody? Okay, this is the last slide, and I have to have add a little caveat. A lot of the principles we have learned here relates to very, very advanced market with significant amount of volume. For example, if you try to do technical analysis in our markets with a limited amount of volume and a limited amount of securities, some of the results will not come out in the way that you would expect it to come out. So that I would always advise that in operating in our markets, that you pay attention to the theory, but always take into account market volumes and whether or not the market reflects the true intrinsic value of the security. Because quite often there could be significant deviation just because of the fact that we have relatively low volumes. So that operating in our markets, you definitely will have to make some adjustment for the fact that we are an embryonic market, and some of the relationship that holds in advanced markets sometimes do not hold in our market. I have to say that because I see people try to use some of the theory in our markets without the recognition that one of the basic assumptions of economics of a perfect market is what? Many buyers and many sellers. And if you don't have that, then the market don't work as perfectly as you'd expect it. And some of the predictions that you would make would not hold. So this covers the portfolio management section. And so this afternoon, we'll just try to do a quick exercise and we'll wrap it up.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Lawrence. Very informative presentation.